The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years, and they just renewed. Thank you very much, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now, although it is the last day of August, the 31st, 2021, the September issue is so chock full of material, I'm going to skip right ahead and start you out a day early on the September edition of Our State magazine celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month is preserved. And there are pictures of preserved fruits and vegetables on the front cover. Some of the articles that they reference are Putting Up the Harvest, Why Our Cherished Food Traditions Still Matter So Much, Scuppernongs. Do you know what they are? Scuppernongs, a toast to our state grape, the lost veggie sandwich of Charlotte, the molasses men of Denton, and the brandy bar in Hendersonville. I don't know if we'll get to them all, but boy, there is a lot to read this month. And we're going to get started, as we always do, with the From Elizabeth column by Elizabeth Hudson, editor-in-chief. And she's entitled this month's column, Back to Basics. She is sitting in an upholstered chair. She is wearing a dark green, fairly dark green dress with big white flowers all over it. And she's smiling at us from behind her bespeckled face and her brown bangs and her brown hair that hangs down to her shoulders. So now you know pretty much what she looks like. In the early morning hours before school, I could hear the low thunder of the logging trucks, the 18-wheelers, the tractor trailers hauling their loads of Trimberlink timber to McDowell Lumber, the sawmill just down the road from my house on Old Highway 49 in Asheboro. The trucks carried poplar, red oak, and white oak, bare-limbed and cut into 50-foot lengths, perfectly stacked under the beds like toothpicks. These logs were on their way to becoming cabinets and doors, furniture and floors. In fact, the floors in the house where I grew up were cut from white oak trees, hewn right on our property when the house was built and then milled for us at McDowell's. Every morning I'd pad down the stairs and across those floors, sleepy-headed and barefooted, to the breakfast table. A solid oak piece like the floors that my parents found in a High Point antique shop in 1973. I'd slide out of my chair, solid ash made for us by Bowling Furniture in Siler City. My dad already at the table with his coffee, my mom in the kitchen slicing bananas for her bowl of Special K. I ate Pop-Tarts or chocolate carnation breakfast bars and drank Tang, choices that are unthinkable to me now. My adult tastes evolved to pastured eggs and whole wheat toast and real fruit rather than my beloved fruity pebbles and apple jacks, which, to my knowledge, contained no actual apples. It's funny how things, taste styles, changed over time, and there was plenty of artificiality in the world I knew back then. We replaced my metal lunchbox with plastic Tupperware. My friends and I filled our mouths with Pop Rocks and sucked colored syrup made from Lord knows what out of wax bottles. By the eighth grade, I was learning to shadow my eyes with unnatural shades of powder blues and neon purples. My grandmother put aside her cotton dresses in favor of polyester pantsuits. My dad built a gazebo inside my mom's craft shop in the Randolph Mall so she could stock faux flowers, silk and nylon for wreaths and floral arrangements. Such were the times. Eventually, as they all do, the classics return. Farmers' markets have popped up everywhere in North Carolina. People have embraced gardening, canning, pickling, and preserving once again. Back to basics. The old ways made new. Our Tupperware got packed away, and it's been a long time since I peeled back the foil on a TV dinner. These days, when I have supper with my mom, meatloaf made from scratch, a homemade banana pudding, I slide a chair back from the table, one of those same bowling furniture chairs that I've always known. Now, though, I sit in the one that was my dad's. Not quite filling the space he left, but comfortable in knowing that the wood is still as solid and strong as the day it was built. And now, with no musical fanfare this week, or this month, I should say, I'm going to interpret the photo essay for those of you who cannot see it, or cannot see it well enough to fully enjoy it. Hopefully I'll do a good job of telling you what the pictures are here, but there's a lot of text this month, which is why no music. It is entitled Collecting Carolina. From UNC Chapel Hill's Wilson Library, housing what's believed to be the largest library collection in the country devoted to a single state, to personal troves of duck decoys, pottery pieces, trains, tractors, and more, meet the passionate collectors who curate the past and present, the serious and curious, the tangible items that tell the story of life in North Carolina. This is written by Jimmy Tomlin. And on the left of the title page, we certainly see the head of a duck decoy, not one that was painted yesterday, I might add. And it says, this Canada goose, made of wire, wood, and canvas, is one of about 1,000 decoys owned by Charlotte collector Croghi Anderson. It was created in the 1940s by Ned Burgess of Church's Island in Currituck County, which was then a hotbed of decoy carving. So, given that this has been around a long time, I'll tell you the paint is a little cracked, but that's not necessarily all bad because the artist did try to show us the feathers by the way the original decoy was carved, and then the paint showed through some little ridges, if you will. But I think these cracks in the duck's breast here, which is white, are just cracks of age instead of intentional feathering there. And we see some other little defects in the paint that have showed up over the year. But the head of the duck is black. Excuse me, the head of the goose is black, and it curves out. There's a line, and I'm not sure it's really intentional, but it looks like maybe the beak was put on separately and it's starting to fall off or whatever. And then underneath the chin area, there is white, and there are no eyes carved or painted onto the duck. The black stops abruptly at the end of the neck and turns to a coffee color brown for the back and a white for the breast. And I guess it just has to look something like the original to attract the birds that you're trying to attract with a decoy. There's a few vases or vases, if you prefer, on the right-hand side, and we'll probably be talking some about that during somebody's collection. Flipping the page, North Carolina Collection, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It may seem presumptuous, if not downright preposterous, to refer to a repository of all things North Carolina as the North Carolina Collection, as if there were no other collection of North Carolina that mattered. Clearly, other collections do matter, but probably none so much as this one. Yes, the North Carolina collection, which is believed to be the largest library collection in the country, devoted to a single state. The collection, housed in the Wilson Library Special Collections at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, contains more than 4 million photographs alone, not to mention more than 300,000 books, pamphlets, documents, microforms, maps, postcards, and so much more, all of them somehow connected to North Carolina. Perhaps you'd like to explore the mammoth photo collection of beloved North Carolinian Hugh Morton, who not only founded Grandfather Mountain, but was also an accomplished photographer who captured some grand moments of the state's colorful history. Or maybe you'd like to see the Durant Bible, the book believed to have been in North Carolina longer than any other since the 1660s. It's a small personal Bible, says Robert Bob Anthony, curator of the collection for 27 years before retiring in May. The chancellors have used it, and Governor Pat McCrory used it for his installation ceremony. It's symbolically very important because it represents the introduction of the written word into North Carolina. If you're drawn to famous names, the collection has you covered with its memorabilia associated with such North Carolinian natives as Billy Graham, Andy Griffith, Thomas Wolfe, Ava Gardner, and Dolly Madison, to name a few. And I'm going to stop at this point to describe the photographs that come with this article on the right-hand page. Photographer Hugh Morton, who's pictured in the top right with Grandfather Mountain's Mildred the Bear and her adopted cubs, captured Cape Hatteras Lighthouse on the opposite page, Governor Terry Sanford and USS North Carolina, visitors to the Jockeys Ridge Sand Dunes, and Michael Jordan making a winning basket at UNC's Carmichael Auditorium. So here is one of a gazillion pictures of the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. This one's a period piece. You can just tell by the way the woman's hair is done, the cut of her blouse, and the length and blossoming way of her skirt flowing out. And I comment on that just because I did the audio description for Beehive at Raleigh Little Theater's amphitheater last weekend, and it was all about the music of the 60s. And during the show, the ladies who were singing would keep changing their outfits to show how they over that period of time, the skirts got tighter and shorter, and then eventually went into a hippie style. But this woman looks like it must be early 60s based on the amount of blossoming there is in her skirt. Although there is another woman here with a pair of slacks, but their hairstyles look, they might be 60s. And in the background, against a very bright blue sky, is the lighthouse itself. And the woman that I was referring to with the red blouse is flying a kite. And there's another woman standing there holding on her straw hat. What's interesting about this is he looks like he either printed this picture or took this picture through a screen, because there's very clearly a screen, a very even screening effect, but at a slight angle in the photograph. Very unusual. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. Over here on the right-hand side, we talked about Hugh Morton, and he's with those bears, and it's not certainly something you don't want to know do unless you know that bear very, very well, which he did, and he's got his camera in his hand, and he's reaching out toward the bear and her cubs, something I certainly don't recommend doing. And here's Governor Terry Sanford, and he's got a sailor's cap on and some kind of a parka. And the weather does not look very good with the USS North Carolina in the background. And here's Michael way up in the air, mouth wide open, that ball way overhead. He's about to slam it into the basket. And here are the Jockeys Ridge Sand Dunes with a family holding hands, making footprints against the butterscotch-colored sand dunes. Overleaf, there's that Bible, I think, that was referred to earlier, coming in the family in the 1600s. It says, the Bible, that something, the Holy Scriptures contained in the Old and New Testament, and then it gets too small to read, except it says, imprinted at London, 1599. And that's all written in a heart that was drawn in the center. And all around it are what I'm going to call block prints, if you know what they were. They were done carved into blocks, and then the block was stamped in some ink, and then it was rolled onto the paper here. So these are images of people dressed in clothing of the time with names like Levi, I can't read some of the letters here, Dan, Gad, Matthew, Bartholomew, Philip, John, James, very familiar names from the Bible, of course, a very ornate cover. And there's a picture of Bob Anthony in a blue shirt and blue tie smiling at us under his full head of white hair. And there's some people that will probably be referenced in the text here, standing in a line getting some food out of large pots. It looks like it might be a church luncheon or something. And then there's pictures of David Lowry Swain, obviously from a long time ago, given the way that he's dressed. He's holding a book rested against his left knee. He's got a white shirt and a jacket on and something around his neck. I can't tell exactly what it is. And a picture of Mary Lindsay Thornton. And on the right-hand side, the North Carolina collection holds stories of Singleton Anderson, who taught black students at the Rosenwald School in Rocky Point, Omar Ibn Said, an Islamic scholar enslaved in North Carolina, whose works written in Arabic include an autobiography, a Carborough Mills employee picnic in 1954, and the Durant Bible. And those are the pictures that are around the page here. So not exactly sure where I left off when I was reading this. I know I wanted to cover the things that were on here, so I'm just going to assume it was someplace around here. North Carolina has been known as the Rip Van Winkle State, Anthony explains. And Swain, or maybe, let me see. I guess I'll start here. North Carolina has been known as the Rip Van Winkle State, Anthony explains, and Swain was convinced that if Carolinians knew more about their history, they would take pride in developing the state. Swain initially stored the items in his office, but they eventually evolved into a formal collection known as the North Carolina Collection. The collection's first curator, Mary Lindsay Thornton, was hired in 1917, which dates her picture on this page. The goal is to collect and make available on-site these resources for anyone interested in the materials, Anthony says. You don't have to be a UNC student. They're available to anyone from the general public. We're here to be the palace of record for published North Carolina. Parts of the collection are being digitized so that people can access them throughout the university's library's website. It would be impossible to list everything you can find in the North Carolina collection. Since narratives, city directories, or slave narratives, city directories, school yearbooks, political memorabilia, historic artifacts from the bronze plate for the cornerstone of Old East, the first building on UNC's campus, to the watch worn by geologist Elisha Mitchell, who confirmed that Mount Mitchell is the highest peak on the East Coast when he fell to his death in 1857. The lore is that the watch broke when Mitchell fell and thus shows the exact time of his death. Want to know the time he died? The North Carolina collection can provide the answer, and millions of others, whenever you're ready. There are 200 South Road in Chapel Hill. Web address is library.unc.edu/Wilson/NCC. And now, gathering steam in Carthage. There's no fancy backstory to the origin of the annual Ederville train and tractor show in Carthage. My husband bought a tractor, Patty Eder explains with a chuckle. Then her husband Ken bought another and another. Then he bought a steam engine, and before the couple knew it, the collection had become, well, a runaway train. This year's show, November 5th to 7th, will be the 16th annual event, with more than 10,000 visitors expected to come see the seemingly endless display of old tractors and antique steam engines, some dating as far back as the 1800s. Many of the names are familiar. John Deere, Caterpillar, International, and Stanley Steamer, for example. But the collection even includes machinery from overseas. Nostalgia Buffs will enjoy Eaterville's other collectible displays, from antique dolls and women's clothing to a vintage telephone switchboard, but the machinery steals the show. I especially enjoyed seeing older people remember when they worked on a farm with their farmer, with a father or grandfather, Patty says, or seeing young kids amazed at how big these things are. The enjoyment I get is watching others enjoy it. Unfortunately, Ken died in 2018, but his legacy continues full steam ahead. And here's Patty. It says, every fall, Patty Eater, pictured in front of a rare 1890 Altman Taylor Bevel Gear steam engine, invites the public to Moore County to view the antique trains and tractors she collected with her husband, Ken. You can learn more at EatervilleNC.com. Now, this is, she's wearing a bright red top, and she's standing in front of a bright green side on this, let's see, what was it called? Altman Taylor engine. Part of it's folded away in the center here. I couldn't read it. It's round, like a barrel put on its side, like a steam engine, you know, on a train used to be. They used to be round. Well, it's kind of like that, but it's got some extra tanks on the side, and you can see the piping leading into them, and it's red on the top, and it has small metal wheels in front and huge metal wheels in back, and this one has something else sticking out to the side, and there's another wheel there, and it looks like plow something going into the ground. And there's several of these. There's actually four of these all lined up in a row. They're probably different manufacturers, but all the same purpose. Overleaf, Eaterline Train and Tractor Show, originally called 100 Plus Years of Progress, shows off the machines that propelled farming forward, including those made by Waterloo Gasoline Engine Company, John Deere, Oliver, and more. The wood-clad portable steam engine by W.R. Grayson Company, shown above, was made in Chile. Now, it is round, like it's a long cylinder, but three-quarters of it in the center are covered by wooden boards. Perhaps that's to help a little bit insulate it to keep the steam warmer on the inside. It's got all metal wheels, bigger in the back than in front, and a very tall smokestack up front. And I think that's because you don't want the steam, hot steam, coming back and blowing out in the face of the person who's riding on the back of it. And we see those classic John Deere green little tractors in the back with John Deere written in yellow. Here's a big steering wheel with a what used to be called in a car a suicide knob, but this is not a suicide knob because it doesn't go fast enough and because it's not connected on by just a couple of little straps. This is hard bolted on there to help turn the wheel because you didn't have any power steering in those days, and it's all red. And here's a front end of an Oliver 60 tractor. Overleaf, miniatures in, or rather villages in miniature in Hillsboro. Stephen Burke and Randy Campbell may collect small buildings, but there's nothing else small about their unique slice of Americana. Our collection of American folk art buildings is the nation's largest and only such, Burke says, matter-of-factly. That's a bold claim, but it's not bragging if you can back it up. And with their assembled community of miniature buildings now numbering close to 1,300, these two can back it up. About two-thirds of the buildings are on display in their Hillsboro home and in two smaller structures on their property built specifically to showcase the collection, while the rest remain in storage. handcrafted by individuals rather than mass-produced. The scaled-down structures represent the buildings found in American communities, from charming houses and stately churches to storefronts, gas stations, and factories. Others, though, represent well-known, specifically identifiable buildings. The U.S. Capitol, George Washington, Mount Vernon Home, buildings in North Carolina's Old Salem District. The collection began in 1985 when Burke spied a small building on a shelf in an antique shop and couldn't resist. 36 years later and more than 1,000 buildings later, he still finds it hard to resist, but he's learning. Even a berserk, passionate collector like I am needs to have some restraint, he says. And on this page, we see a Ferris wheel, what looks to be a brick front building. We see yellow fences. We see churches, a whole bunch of churches. And in fact, something says Astor on the front of it, Overleaf, the diner. It says these may be small, but Burke and Campbell's buildings aren't dollhouses. Some document real-life structures. Others were part of a train set or a Christmas tableau. All represent American contributions to world architecture, like the local diner. It says two of them side by side here. One is a little more primitive than the other. This one has a door that actually works, and you can see a blonde-haired woman sitting at a table inside, and there is glass in the front. And the other one, it looks like it's made out of clay, perhaps. No, I guess not, because I could see some nails where it's broken away, but it's just painted a clay color, and the door is painted on. And down below, here's a house with a garage and a rubber duck, for some reason, sitting in the driveway. Hometown Proud in Statesville. Half a century after he began collecting memorabilia related to Statesville, his beloved hometown, Steve Hill sheepishly admits at some point things got out of hand. Not that that's a bad thing. Hill's massive menagerie of memorabilia, the Statesville Historical Collection, is a museum-sized scrapbook of life in Statesville and Iredell County. From an approximately 500,000 vintage photographs he's amassed, 500,000 to the countless artifacts that offer telling glimpses of the city's past. The collection abounds with remnants of the three products that propelled the city's growth in the late 1800s, tobacco, liquor, and medicinal roots and herbs, including what was once believed to be the largest herbarium in the world. Other exhibits pay homage to various folks who once called Statesville home, from professional athletes to successful authors to NASA astronaut Thomas Marshburn, and to the numerous movies filmed there. Hill began collecting Statesvilliana as a teenager, and he never quit. The basis for the whole thing has been the sense of pride in my community, he says. We have a fascinating town, a fascinating history, and it's a story that needs to be shared. Picture, Steve Hill hopes that people will visit the Statesville Historical Collection located at 212 North Center Street to see thousands of items, including this image of the town in the late 1930s and a phone that served as a direct line to the fire department from the downtown shopping district between the 30s and the 50s. And indeed, a black and white photo with all those cars like you'd expect them to look. And guess what the store is? J.C. Penney Company. Well, my friends, that is about all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine, which is a shame because I haven't finished the pictorial. Hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org, and on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.